morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz is my guest this morning. County police will start rolling out body cameras in just a couple of weeks amid concerns about police transparency. Sparrows Point is taking a big step towards its transformation from a steel mill to an industrial complex as it becomes Trade Point Atlantic and hundreds of thousands of cars start passing through on their way to America's highways. We'll talk about what Kamenetz thinks the county's role can be in helping Baltimore City bounce back from the uprising and what was the deal with that flap about air conditioning. Plus, a dynamic young conductor, Teddy Abrams, leads this year's edition of the National Orchestral Institute. Can young performers inspire young listeners to pick up the habit of classical music? Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. We're beginning a new series called Focus on the Counties, in which we'll feature conversations with county executives from across the region. First up is Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. Mr. Kamenetz was elected in 2010. Prior to that, he served on the county council for 16 years, starting in 1994. He began his public service career as a prosecutor in the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. He's a lifelong resident of Baltimore County, a graduate of the Gilman School, Johns Hopkins University, and the University of Baltimore School of Law. He and his wife, Jill, live in Owings Mills with their two sons. Kevin Kamenetz joins me in Studio A. Mr. County Executive, always a pleasure.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you here. So let's get this out of the way right from the top. What was the deal with this flap with the governor and the comptroller about the air conditioning?
Well, you know, when I was elected in 2010, and it's interesting, you know, Baltimore County is a large jurisdiction, but we kind of grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and basically all of our infrastructure is now 50 and 60 years old. So when I took office in 2010, we were faced with a situation of what I call the twin dilemma of aging infrastructure of our schools and rising enrollment. 80% of our schools are more than 40 years old. Just 52% of our schools were air conditioned. So what we decided to do was embark on a historic $1.3 billion Schools for Our Future program in which we are building 15 new schools, 11 additions. We're modernizing our schools, adding public safety features, Wi-Fi technology, and also adding central air. No county in the history of this state has ever undertaken such a historic commitment to school construction in this limited period of time. And, of course, it's the right thing to do for Baltimore County and for our residents. Obviously, we want to give our kids a modern learning environment, but we also recognize that quality school buildings help the reputation of the school system, and that's the most important thing that people look at when they want to move into a neighborhood. So new schools and modernization of our schools are a good tool in stabilizing neighborhoods. So we've been very consistent with this plan, and this plan was initiated before Governor Hogan even took office. Unfortunately, what's happened is the comptroller and now Governor Hogan have jumped into this idea of air conditioning schools, and we agree. I mean, we've gone now from, I said 52% were air conditioned when I took office. As of this year, funding is in place, or we have already completed air conditioning for 85% of our schools. In the coming fiscal year, we'll be at 90, and we're going to complete the job in the next 3 years. But it's not just about putting air conditioners. It's doing all the other stuff, adding seats. We're going to have 8,000 surplus seats to accommodate future growth. And we do things in Baltimore County the right way. For the governor to suggest somehow that we should just go to Home Depot and load up a U-Haul and plug in room air conditioners really isn't a thoughtful response.
Well, last we left this, as far as I can tell, the governor was asking for a detailed plan. Have you given him that? And
well,
has
that plan has been in, around for years.
So it's the same plan.
Of course, unfortunately.
But aren't you going to be able to accelerate the pace in which the rooms are actually cooled off?
Well, it's not the rooms being cooled off. It's accelerating our school construction program. For every $1 we've received from the state, we are putting two county dollars in. So what we said was, since the governor won't put up more money to match what we're doing, we're going to forward fund the state's portion and expect prompt reimbursement from them. When we say a plan,
so you can do it quicker than you at one point.
Well, we're moving it up. We're moving it up 18 months by forward funding the state's portion. When I talk about a plan, in Baltimore County, we're great stewards of fiscal responsibility. We have a AAA bond rating from all three Wall Street rating agencies. We're just one of 42 counties to have a AAA, and that has saved us $38 million since I took office in avoided interest costs, extra higher interest rates. So when we talk about a plan, though, it means that we have scheduled this out in voter referendums for bonds over the years. It's not something we suddenly just come up with. It's part of our plan, our long-term planning of how do we fund these types of projects in a fiscally responsible manner. So the governor obviously is suggesting we should just plug in temporary window units, ignores the fact that the buildings that are remaining are the oldest, and they don't have the wiring that could handle window units.
Why do you think the governor and the comptroller have inserted themselves in this very specific building maintenance issue in Baltimore County? What's that all about?
Well, look, it's pretty obvious that they don't want to hear the facts. You say, well, they have to see a plan. Well, the plan has always been there. The IAC, the Interagency Committee on School Construction from the state, has already approved our plan over the years. And in fact, when the governor played this game of withholding money from us until we put room air conditioning in this fall, which is actually a physical impossibility because you have to go through procurement law and bid these things out, let alone all the construction you need for new wiring. The director of the IAC, very well-respected man by the name of David Lever, who has served under three governors, two Republicans and one Democrat, resigned in protest. I think that suggests that the governor is ignoring the facts. He refused to allow Dr. Dance to even speak and address these allegations, saying we don't need to hear from him. It just shows...
So this is political grandstanding on his part.
Well, it certainly seems that way. I think if you reach that conclusion, I think that's probably a reasonable one.
Your relationship with him, is it just on this downward trajectory? I mean, Stephanie Rawlings Blake here in the city, when the uprising occurred a couple months ago, there were all sorts of reports of really bad blood between the mayor of the city of Baltimore and the governor. You have this huge jurisdiction. The jurisdiction you oversee is 250,000 more people than the city of Baltimore. It's huge.
Interestingly, Baltimore County's population is larger than that of four states.
Yeah.
It's a large jurisdiction. You say downward trajectory. That would assume that it was at a high point at some point. Frankly, the governor.
But isn't it important that you guys get along? I mean, you've got a lot of people to serve.
We would like to. The governor has never communicated with me on any substantive issue since he took office. He has never responded to any substantive correspondence I've written to him. His office doesn't consult with us before he makes appointments to our school board and our community college board and other boards where I can tell you Governor O'Malley was, by contrast, extremely responsive to the needs of Baltimore County and worked hand in hand with me on every issue in which the state had contact with Baltimore County. So, that's how Mr. Hogan chooses to operate. I think it's to the detriment of our residents in Baltimore County, but we're going to continue to do the job that we think is the right way to operate a government.
Kevin Kamenetz is the Baltimore County Executive. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR. You are in the middle of your second term as County Executive. Your term limited, can't run for a third term, at least a third consecutive term. It's widely assumed or thought that you'll be running for governor. Peter Franchot, the comptroller, certainly investigated that possibility the last time around, and it's assumed that he's going to be investigating that possibility again. Mr. Franchot is another person who's inserted himself in this building maintenance issue and some other things. Is this just sort of a, is this kind of political posturing by two folks who are possibly going to be, opponents in the race for the Democratic nomination for governor in 2018?
Well, listen, some folks think they lead by grandstanding. We lead by action here in Baltimore County, and I have a track record. We're fiscally responsible, yet we also recognize the fundamental difference here is that I think is lacking right now in state, from the executive branch. We recognize that government can do good things, and I think the messaging somehow that government is broke and it needs to be fixed, and we have to cut. Really is just short-term politics to the peril of long-term good policy decisions for the state. I think in Baltimore County, when we talk about leading by example, we haven't raised the property tax rate in 28 years. We haven't raised the income tax rate in 24 years. I don't think there's any jurisdiction our size in the country that can match that rate. So we understand fiscal discipline, but we also understand that government is here to achieve good things. So we talked about this school construction program. We have great initiatives for the environment in Baltimore County. Baltimore County, two-thirds of our county is zoned rural in nature and has some of the most conservative zoning in the country, one house every 50 acres. 80% of our population live on 30% of the land. And in the rural areas, we make sure that we maintain the 2,000 miles of streams and tributaries that protect the region's water supply through the reservoirs that then supply the metropolitan district.
If you're just joining us, my guest this morning on Maryland Morning is Kevin Kamenetz, the county executive of Baltimore County. This is our first installment of our Focus on the Counties series. Over the summer, we'll be speaking with other county executives around the region as well. Mr. County Executive, let's talk about the North Point Government Center and the development plans you have for that. There's another controversy that involved Mr. Franchot and the governor. This is an important project for Dundalk. It seems to be stuck. You are suggesting that the county sell some land the county owns to private developers to do some retail and residential units and whatnot. Where does that stand, and what do you think is going to be the final disposition?
Again, I think it's an issue of the governor promoting petty politics over good long-term policy, particularly for the Dundalk area where we are in a concentrated effort to revive the economy in Dundalk and breathe new life there. So obviously we have that great Sparrows Point story that we've been working on that's going to bring 10,000 jobs there within and good-paying jobs there within the next 10 years. The government center issue is an interesting one because if people listen to the facts, I think they understand it, they get it. But we're having difficulty for the governor to acknowledge what the facts are. We own a building that used to be a junior high school that was built in 1953. The school system passed title to the county. The county then used it starting in the early 80s as a police station and added the recreational use for the community there to allow them to have access to that. It is so old. It is not ADA compliant. It has asbestos. It has failing heating systems and is in great disrepair. It would cost us more to maintain the building than it would to to even build a new building. So what we decided to do was to offer the building up for sale. Rather than just build a brand new community building, we would offer the school building for sale. The fields would remain, but offer the school building for sale to a private developer who could then bring needed services and jobs to that community, and in exchange use the proceeds to construct a brand new modern community building that would have all the same amenities that the community is currently using there on another location on the site.
There was a fair amount of community opposition to this plan, at least originally, though.
Well, I think there is a vocal minority who again, are misled as to what we're trying to do here. But the bottom line is the police, we've rather than they needed a modern facility, and we've moved them to that new location. So the building is virtually empty now. The holdup is, and by the way, this new development, let me just talk about that. When I talked to the people of Dundalk, they told me, we want some of these name brand stores that we have to, restaurants that we have to leave our community to patronize. Why can't we spend our money in Dundalk? And there, so this new development is going to have a Chipotle, a Five Guys, you know, Chick-fil-A, some of these other things that they feel does not exist already there. But it also is going to have a satellite office, satellite facility of Johns Hopkins Hospital, where they're going to provide medical services for the community there.
But this is going to happen. I mean, the Board of Estimates, you know, sort of didn't even put it on the agenda.
Well, here's what's happened. The county council has approved the contracts. They've approved the sale. The developer's ready to move forward. We want to start construction of this brand-new community center. We work with the rec councils to design this facility. They're happy with it. There's a provision in the deed from 1981 that says that the Board of Public Works has to give final approval in Annapolis, final approval to transfer the deed, such consent not to be unreasonably withheld. And the interpretation was that because there was some an outstanding school construction bond associated with that building back in 1981, that it was reasonable for the Board of Public Works to have an interest in it. Well, those bonds were paid off in the 80s. The IAC, once again, has approved
the sale.
So you're
saying they shouldn't even be involved in it?
Well, of course not. So,
But they are. They've managed to hold it up.
Again, it's you know...
It's politics.
It appears to be so because they are unreasonably withholding consent, such that the developer went to court and a judge, a circuit court judge in Baltimore County, ruled that the Board of Public Works... should not have any role in this.
How's it going to
resolve? The state
How's
appealing.
This going to happen?
Well, you know, the governor likes to say that Maryland is open for jobs. Unfortunately, I don't get the sense that it's open, you know, the way he's acting. I guess it's not open for business in Dundalk. It's again, not in the long-term governing interests of the state to act this way.
But no end in sight at the moment. No resolution to this.
Well, the state is now appealing it to the Court of Special Appeals. I think they're going to lose there too. And again, the only people who are suffering are the people in Dundalk who don't have a brand new building now, and we've got an eyesore on the corner.
Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. You are a great proponent of regionalism. Baltimore County provided about $250,000 in police and public safety assistance when we had violence in the city streets more than a year ago, then forgave that debt, as it were. A lot of folks, certainly in the city, applauded you for that. And you didn't get all that much pushback from your constituents in Baltimore County, it seems to me. You got some, but... One place where you always get pushback, it seems, is in the issue of affordable housing. And just a few months ago, there was a discriminatory housing lawsuit brought against the county that was resolved. And part of the resolution of that called for you to introduce legislation to the county council that would forbid landlords to refuse to rent to tenants and provide Section 8 vouchers. There is opposition throughout Baltimore County to having low-income families move into their neighborhoods. And you agreed to introduce this legislation. I think you have until September to do it. As far as I know, you haven't done it yet. What's the timetable for that?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the broader issue. It's very important when we talk about regionalism and especially what occurred a year ago. Obviously, there are some issues that go on between the relationship between the police and city residents. And, you know, a lot of that outcry was as a result of that poor relationship. But also, a lot of that was the suggestion that there are generations of poverty that exist in Baltimore City neighborhoods and certain neighborhoods, and it's not reasonable. So if you think about over the years, different groups, ethnic groups, have come into the city, emigrated here, and achieved over the generations. Each generation got more affluent and more educated, and yet you have certain neighborhoods in Baltimore City where they are not enjoying that same generational success. So I think one of the issues is whether there is access, of course, to jobs, and that gets into the transportation issue. But the other is housing. You know, if someone wants to move to a better neighborhood because it has better schools and lower crime and easier access to jobs, well, that makes sense. That's a good thing to encourage. I've never been afraid of anyone who wants to risk moving to an area where they don't know anyone, they have no support system there, but yet they think this is going to help their family improve their lives. That's a good thing. That's the type of people that we want to have as neighbors, because they're motivated to achieve and do better. So what we've recognized is that we have a responsibility in Baltimore County. We have poor people in Baltimore County. We have homeless people in Baltimore County. You know, we're a very diverse population. We are 35% non-white in Baltimore County. But we also recognize as a region, we have an obligation to help people. And what we've said is that we will assist in the creation of 10,000 affordable units within the next 12 years. The legislation, which you refer to, is generally known as source of income, and it's been debated for the past several years in Annapolis. It just says that a landlord, when reviewing a tenant's application, cannot deny them based upon their source of income. That is, if you have alimony or child support or vouchers in place, that is not a basis in which to discriminate their income. And in fact, I submit that if you had a federal voucher, that's probably more reliable than alimony or child support.
What do you say to your constituents who are largely white in places like Cockeysville or Catonsville or Towson or White Marsh, when you say the court has ordered essentially that you make available, you make possible affordable rental homes to be placed in those neighborhoods? Because their concern is going to be that the property values are going to decrease and that there's going to be long-term problems. How do you respond to that perspective?
Well, I don't know that there is a statistical basis to support that fear. But we are not interested in creating new concentrations of poverty. So I don't think that's going to happen. You talked about the legislation. We're going to introduce that the first week of July, and it'll be voted on in the first week of August.
What are your chances of it passing?
Well, we're working with the council and trying to let them understand the merits of this proposal. The other aspect is the housing part, where we have created an economic development fund that we will administer to encourage creation of affordable units, but not a concentration of units. So that if a developer wants to have a new apartment complex, but they want to set aside some of the units for affordable, we will help buy down that cost through this program. But it would have to be according to our standards, and also in areas that we don't feel will create some disparate impact.
And you're confident you'll be able to meet the requirements of the court ruling in every way?
Well, Well, we are going to meet the requirements. I mean, our obligation is to submit the legislation. We can't guarantee what the council does, but it the aspirational goal of, you know, I'm sorry, I said 10,000. It's 1,000 units in 12 years. So right. It's 83 units a year. On average, we are confident we will meet that goal.
Let's talk about the police. You're going to be implementing a body camera program with the county police. Starts just a couple weeks, 1st of July. How long is the rollout for that going to take? How do you think that's going to affect the relationship between county residents and law enforcement?
Well, again, it's a, you know, you want to observe what happens around you so you can better make better decisions. And while I don't think I think we have a pretty good relationship between the police and the community that we serve, we're just one bad incident away from having a problem. So what we want to make sure, we've done a couple things. First of all, we have increase the diversity of our public safety folks. Our police and fire recruit class average 40% non-white male. We've promoted within the rank and file of our police department up to the highest levels. Our number two police officer is African American. And we believe that the use of body cameras will actually improve the relationship or the behavior of both police officers and the citizens that they encounter. I'm a former prosecutor. I also believe that the use of body cameras will aid in the prosecution of cases because where there's just the uncorroborated testimony of a police officer today, if you have a video that backs up that police officer's testimony, I think you're going to have a lot of guilty
verdicts. Baltimore City had a little trouble rolling out their thing. They're still involved in doing it. It's later than usual. You don't anticipate any delays in Baltimore County?
No, not at all. We will have this in place by July 1. Are implementing the use of cameras, starting with officers in each of our precincts. It'll take up to 2 years to fully implement.
We've run out of time. I wish we had more time to talk about Sparrows Point and some other things. But real quick, PayPal, you approached them when they decided to leave Charlotte because of some legislation considered anti-gay in Charlotte, North Carolina. What's their response? What's our chances?
We passed an anti-discrimination law several years ago in Baltimore County. You know, we're a very welcoming county.
They're going to come?
PayPal has 1,000 jobs already in Hunt Valley. We think that this is a logical place for them to take those 400 jobs and attach it to the 1,000 we already have here.
We'll keep our fingers crossed on that one.
Hey, we're working hard. The door's open, and we intend to walk through it.
Thanks for your time. Kevin Kamenetz is halfway through his second term as Baltimore County Executive. We've got links
Not
to the
yet.
County.
I've got almost 2.5 years.
But who's counting, right? We'll have links to the county website at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. First, now it's time for the Environment in Focus.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
It is Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Last week, the League of American Symphony Orchestras held their national conference here in Baltimore around the theme of diversifying classical music in America. This week, at a festival in College Park, the focus is on the next generation of classical musicians and how they can not only diversify music racially, but also generationally. On Saturday night, the National Orchestral Institute in College Park continues with a concert led by Teddy Abrams, a dynamic young conductor who is the music director of the Louisville Orchestra. Since 1988, the Institute has been hosting young musicians who aspire to a professional career in classical music. They are accepted into the program after a rigorous audition process, and they spend about a month playing orchestral and chamber music under the tutelage of experienced professionals. Teddy Abrams is himself a pretty young guy. At 29, he is one of the youngest conductors on the scene today, and he has made it his mission to get more young people interested in attending classical concerts. He joins us on the phone from College Park. Morning, Teddy. How you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Thanks for being with us. So diversity in American orchestras is certainly a problem, and so is attracting younger people. In my other life, I'm a classical musician. I've been conducting concerts for 40 years, and for most of those 40 years, I walk out on stages and I am greeted by a sea of white hair. What's the pitch to young people to start the habit of classical music?
Well, one of the things that I like to talk about is that the music world is so incredibly broad and diverse, and orchestras are a kind of connecting force between so many different ways of making music, different forms of making music, as opposed to being distinct and something that people have to, you know, kind of quote-unquote get into. And this has been a big part of my mission, is that, you know, the orchestral institution, the idea of an orchestra, is so broad, it's so huge, it's so spectacular. And there's no other kind of musical organization that can produce sounds like an orchestra, that should just be impressive in and of itself. And then it's about kind of taking that potential for sound and spreading that in, I think, the most diverse and open and accepting way. And one of the really incredible things about orchestral music is that it can dialogue and fit with so many different styles. Of course, just within what we call classical alone, the diversity between composers from, say, the late Renaissance and through Bach and Mozart, Beethoven, all the way up into Mahler and Stravinsky and Copland. I mean, that music alone is incredibly diverse. And then you think about the broad world of music beyond that that orchestras can fit in with. And I think when you start to look at an orchestra more as kind of a hub for music making or a hub for creative art in a community, then you can start to get people really excited about what is really an institution that belongs to them wherever they happen to live.
The experience of the listener in a classical music concert is something that I've given a lot of thought to over the years. And it's interesting to me that it seems that that experience is incredibly passive. We waltz out on the stage, we turn, we face our orchestra, our chorus, we play music, and folks sit in the audience and they just sort of stare at us and listen. And it seems to me in a way that it's more passive and less kind of viscerally involved than the experience of theater, for example, when you've got people, you know, doing literal dialogue. What's your aspiration when you do a gig? What do you want the orchestra, or the audience rather, to understand, to feel, and to experience when they hear you perform?
Well, that's a very good point about what we're asking of our audiences. And in some cases, I don't think it needs to be that passive. I think that a concert, first of all, is a show. Of course, we're translating these powerful works of music, whatever they happen to be, from whatever era, from the source to the audiences, and that carries a certain amount of nobility and a very high level of artistic requirement to do this well. But on the other hand, it's still a show. Things need to be, I think, as dramatic as an exciting experience as we can possibly make them, and so. It is a challenge always to get that kind of dramatic balance between people having a really personal relationship with the art itself and whatever form that might take, but also creating an environment that's so engaged that people can't help but perhaps have an overwhelming experience with it. And I think for a very long time, a lot of musicians that would consider themselves classical haven't considered the overall experience of a concert, focusing only on the sound itself. And I don't mean that you're then supposed to be jumping up and down and dancing and pandering to anybody. That's the last thing that you'd want to do. But rather thinking about the overall kind of relationship that people are having, not just with the sound, but with every minute that they're involved in this performance, in this form of entertainment, which is such a core part of the musical experience. And it's actually one that would not be unfamiliar to composers like Haydn and Mozart. If you look at the way that a lot of music was played in their era, there was a kind of engaged, maybe kind of energized atmosphere in these concerts that resembles much more a modern jazz or indie rock venue, where there was a lot more kind of dialogue between the performers and the audience. And also, people were just crammed into smaller spaces. There weren't these kind of vast auditoriums where people felt quite far away from the music. And so I think about this all the time.
So is it the visual dimension that you're going to concentrate on then moving forward to bringing people in? Is it the venue itself? I mean, here in Baltimore, we have a beautiful symphony hall. It seats 2,500 people. I mean, it's not an intimate place. It sounds great, but it's not an intimate place. Is the venue and the size of these venues across the country a big part of the challenge?
Well, I think they certainly could be, and part of what orchestras need to do is they need to experiment and try things. A lot of large arts organizations have basically, I'm not talking about orchestras exclusively, but I'm talking about orchestras, museums, ballet institutions, lots of these large, very kind of unwieldy arts groups often don't really put experimentation and research and development on the line. And R&D is the core of not just, I think, you know, any organization's success, but also people's personal success. You have to try things, you have to experiment, and so this relates directly to questions about venue, questions about visuals, questions about use of technology, or whether or not that could make sense or enhance something or detract from it. But we have to experience all of these different things and try things, and eventually I think we'll start to realize that the artistic and creative side of what we do is wide open to us, and it's not limited to simply being a recreative art where we essentially do something precisely the same way month after month or year after year. And so that's one of the really exciting things about living in this era, is that we can experiment with a totally different kind of venue, or we can experiment with collaborations between lots of different artists, which is not out of line or divergent from, I think, the same spirit of great composers of the past and the present. So
Teddy Abrams, he's the music director of the Louisville Orchestra, and on Saturday night, he'll lead the National Orchestral Institute Orchestra in a performance of Mahler's Titan Symphony, along with music of Debussy and Ravel. The show starts at 8 o'clock in the Clarice Smith Performing Arts Center on the campus of the University of Maryland in College Park. The following week, the festival will conclude with Osmo Venska of the Minnesota Orchestra conducting music of Sibelius. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Teddy, break a leg this weekend. I appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up next time, more focus on the arts. Award-winning choreographer Liz Lerman is leaving Baltimore to take a new position at the University of Arizona. And Donald Hicken is retiring after 36 years with the Baltimore School for the Arts. Dancer Sharena Christmas is leaving too. She's going on a trip to Cuba with students from her organization, Muse 360. We'll check in with all of them Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.